The Kris Kringle character was working for Macy's but sending people out to other stores. Well, tonight I'm going to promote the competition a little bit. I've got a couple of guests over from K-Mud. Of course, I'm from K-Mud too, but I'm going to be real careful tonight too, to try to avoid doing the wrong station ID as I'm breaking out. And of course, K-Mud is a sister station. It's not competition. It is symbiosis.
Community and public radio.
Just fine. Yes. I have with me Bob Freilich and Julia Minton, who do a show on KMUD called Thinking Clearly. And I'm going to let one of you go ahead and describe what you do. We're going to talk a little bit about critical thinking tonight and what you're doing with your show and what you're trying to promote. So I'll let you, one of you two, start.
Thanks for having us. My name's Julia Minton, and I've been working with Bob Freilich for about 10 shows now. 11 shows. Yeah. It goes by so
almost
quick.
A year.
Every first Thursday at KMUD, which is a community radio station, we're volunteer programmers. And we're there every first Thursday at 7 p.m. You can also catch us on the archive in case you like to tune into your Thursday night talk.
And I'd like to start off by thanking Eric, because Eric gave us a lot of encouragement to go ahead with this show. He helped us cut our cognitive chops on his show, All Things Reconsidered, and has been sort of a mentor for us. So thank you, Eric.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it, and I do enjoy doing the shows with both of you, and it's kind of fun to do it in a different setting. I did have you once before. I think it was about 2 years ago, almost to the date.
On KHSU.
And why don't we talk a little bit? I'm sort of letting you take this. We'll maybe take calls in about 10, 15 minutes.
It's really wonderful to be here and kind of see the operations of KHSU and how things are done here. And I want to make a remark, though, that it is not competition.
No, it's not.
Because Linda Stansberry does a fine show at the same time we do, the first Thursday, 7 to 8. But both KHSU and KMUD have fine archives, so you don't have to miss one indefinitely. You can pick up the other on the archive.
I love living in the future. It's really exciting. And I have to say, too, I'm taking notes. Cut cognitive chops. My next tattoo. Definitely my next tattoo.
Let's start out maybe by giving a definition of critical thinking. We're kind of proud of this because this is a working definition. You know, we started off our first show and we started off with sort of canned definitions, Webster's Dictionary and Oxford Dictionary. And we've been massaging this definition, building on it. So eventually, we're going to put this out to philosophy instructors and other people to vet this and psychologists to vet this definition. But we're working on it. It's our working definition and tried to pack as much as we could in. And it goes like this. Critical thinking is a mode of thinking which uses the processes of logical reasoning based on a thorough examination and evaluation of a robust cross-section of evidence relevant to the issue at hand when forming claims, conclusions, opinions, and beliefs. Now, that's the first part of the definition.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Let's talk about that a little bit, because we're talking about the subject of critical thinking. What does that mean?
Well, the thing I come back to first most of the time is it's a process. It's not a particular school of thought, and it's not a set of conclusions. It's process and method for examining arguments that have been put before you or that you're making, the evidence that has been put out there to support those arguments, the way premises are constructed. It's all a toolbox of skills to examine arguments that are made. It's not for the purpose of putting people down or telling them they're wrong or dismantling their arguments. If anything, critical thinking contributes to making better arguments.
uses logic. It uses logical reasoning. So we've got to understand that there are premises, and that's where the evidence comes in. But I thought it was important, really, to say robust cross section of the evidence, because often people. And we'll talk probably a little bit about cognitive biases.
But, and confirmation bias.
And confirmation bias being the principal cognitive bias that affects us and, in our beliefs and conclusions. But people tend to look and cherry-pick evidence. They'll kind of dismiss the evidence or gloss over the evidence that contradicts what they are prone to believe. And so a robust cross-section of the evidence means that we're looking at not just evidence to confirm our beliefs, but evidence that might disconfirm our beliefs. And we're weighing the strengths of that evidence.
Well, I don't know about you, but my favorite kind of evidence is the evidence that agrees with what I already believe. So, but actually, I think in a very important foundational, I don't think most logicians would necessarily put this out there, but I think it's important to say that an important foundation to participating in critical thinking is having an open mind and being open to evidence that might surprise you, that might go completely against what your preconceived notions, but you take pause and you say, huh, well, that's interesting. Let's look into that.
It can actually be a very almost exciting experience to actually learn something different from the way you understood it, to actually change your mind about something. I mean, if you're not changing your mind about things, you know, you're not doing your job. And maybe sometimes you change your mind back and forth. You know, we had the steady state theory in place for so many years, and then, you know, the Big Bang theory came, and then somebody every once in a while raises some arguments that maybe there's something to the steady state theory, and it's not a completely different thing. And then sometimes you leads to a synthesis of it, and the whole idea is that you get closer to truth, but you got to attack your assumptions. I mean, that's what I kind of see it as. You've got to be ready to attack your assumptions. That line in Contact, which was the one where Jodie Foster is trying to contact aliens, and they get this signal, and the first thing she says when she gets back with all her colleagues into the room is, "Make me a liar. What is the alternative to this? We want to believe this is aliens. Attack it. Find every way to attack it." And they go through one by one in each and every possibility. And it should be that if you're confident in what you believe, first of all, then it should stand up to attack, right? You should be able to attack it and really focus more on the, if anything, on the evidence and agreements that disagree with you. Find something that weakens it, because if your goal is eventually to promote that idea, you're only going to strengthen it.
Sure. We look around us and see that our room is getting messy. We clean it up. We see that our garage is just unfit for human habitation. We clean it up. Why not clean up our cognitive closet, you know?
Yeah.
There's a mess in that gray room that needs to be cleaned up every once in a while and address those issues.
And I would add that you and I might get a thrill out of changing our mind on occasions, but sometimes it's a very uncomfortable experience.
Yes,
I mean,
sure.
If you remember finding out that Santa Claus wasn't real, sorry to break it to you, folks, but they can really, we're not mechanical. We're not these mechanical, logical robots. We're humans, and that's an incredible part of the human experience. But with that comes sometimes attachments we don't even know we have.
Well, let's go on with the definition.
Sure.
We're going on with the definition of the working definition of critical thinking. It begins with an awareness of and attempt to compensate for the vulnerabilities we all have in our thought processes, including cognitive biases and confirmation bias.
Mm-hmm.
So on our show, we've done a couple shows, one of them on all kinds of biases and heuristics that are called, which are kind of rules of thumb that we use, quick and dirty kinds of ways that we come to some sort of decision or conclusion. And the last part is, when communicating our ideas using critical thinking, we're willing to acknowledge evidence contrary to our conclusions and consider alternative conclusions and beliefs. And both of you already talked about that part of the definition. Sure. So this is our working definition. It's a comprehensive process, as Julia mentioned, and help us on our definition. You can come to our Facebook page on Thinking Clearly Radio. Just type that up in the search bar of Facebook. You'll come to our Facebook page, and we have our working definition there. Make a comment about it. Help us improve it.
We love feedback from folks. It expands our horizons.
All right. I always thought that, and sometimes our conversations get repetitive, but I think it bears repeating to this one because we've talked these things over and over again. But you know, when people ask me who I think the most important scientist was in history, I always say Kepler. And the reason is that Kepler, for the longest time in his life, believed in God. He was a deep believer in God, and he believed that the five planets that were known at that time, maybe it's six planets, I forget, but of the planets that were known at the time, there was some correlation with the five perfect solids, their orbits and the five perfect solids. And he spent a lot of time trying to come up with it because he could almost make it fit. He had a model. He spent a couple decades on it, actually. Finally, he got the data that Tycho Brahe, the astronomer, crazy king up in Denmark, gave to him after a long period of time. And when he had the data and was able to make the calculations and came up with the three laws of Kepler, he finally had to let go of that. He said, okay, no, there's no, it's out of the world. I take that as, because here is a scientist who applied science to his own process that he had a deep emotional belief in as well, and he gave it up and he said no, what I've been trying to prove for the past 20-30 years of my life is crap. It has no basis in reality, and it's time to give it up. That is a heroic moment, and I see that as greater than any eureka moment in science. That's what I see as critical thinking about is a willingness to give up on deeply held ideas and notions like Santa Claus or anything else in pursuit of the truth, because that pursuit, in some of our opinion, is more beautiful than any kind of truth you can find. It's once you find it.
Well, the other thing, I think we have to sort of make a case, and we've been trying to do this on Thinking Clearly, for the importance of critical thinking. I mean, why do that? It's a lot of work. It's a lot easier to stick with our beliefs.
I don't want to clean my room.
I know. Who does? But why is that important? And as I think about it, it's especially important in this day and age where, and I kind of put this to some extent on the World Wide Web, because on the World Wide Web, you can find any kind of idea or belief, from flat earth to I don't know where, but there's all kinds of beliefs that are you're exposed to in our information feeds. We are bogus health claims, theories that are really out there in terms of plausibility. So there's a lot of different information that we're experiencing.
And you can always find some articulate person on YouTube with great music and graphics.
That's right. That's right. Or someone citing and cherry-picking the evidence, not doing a robust search of the evidence. So I think that's an important thing, is to realize why we should do this work and why it's important to do. Personally, because it's not easy.
It does. It takes work, and it is easier to cling to the beliefs that we hold than to challenge them or to attempt to expand horizons or to even explore things that we don't have beliefs about. But I do think you're onto something. I'm not necessarily a Luddite myself. I'm a bit of a techno fan, I guess. But the way we're interacting, especially with the internet, is definitely changing the way we consume information. We've talked about things like filter bubbles, for instance. There's a gentleman whose name I can't remember at the moment wrote a book about it, and he did a fabulous TED Talk. But filter bubbles are basically the way that, say, let's use Google, for instance, since it's a common in our vernacular, go Google it. You go Google something, well, guess what? If I Google flat Earth, and if Bob Googles flat Earth, we're going to get different results based on our previous Googling history and based on our previous browsing history. Mm-hmm. It's not like it used to be where you go, you pick up the New York Times and we all read the same front page. That's not happening at all.
Right.
In fact, some people will never read what's on the front page. They'll only read what they seek to read, what interests them. And so our exposure to information and our understanding of how it's being served to us is rapidly changing. I think that's part of the reason we need to understand more about how it is being served to us so we can take these things into account. When I Google Egypt in Google, I'll understand that the news items it's serving to me is based on an educated bias. And then I know to go to DuckDuckGo or another, a linear web search engine that will give me a more objective result where Bob and I will have the same results. Mm-hmm. That's just one facet in which the way we get information served to us is changing. And we're certainly seeing that now with the news. Accusations by prominent officials that news is fake news. You can't even tell heads from tails sometimes unless you actually take a minute to do the work and to look at it. If it's not work, I often find myself asking, am I letting myself off easy? Am I just wrapping myself in a blanket and taking a nap with the information that I want to believe is true?
And with your group, with your clan, you know, you're intellectually the ones that you identify with, because sometimes taking a different position can cost you, mm-hmm. you respect, cost you something like that. If you start rethinking, for instance, nuclear power, for instance, that's something I've rethought as I've gotten older. I'm not an advocate for nuclear power. I'm still very cynical. What's going on up in Washington State right now has me very concerned. But I think about it a little bit differently than when I was getting arrested outside of Diablo Canyon several decades ago. I think about it in a different way because the technology has changed. There are a lot of people who are very upset with me at it, saying I'm selling out, saying, blah, blah, blah. But and I haven't even come around to endorsing it. I'm just saying I'm rethinking it, and it can cost me.
So you're saying you have basically like personal repercussions sometimes,
sure,
for changing your mind. I joke, living in Southern Humboldt in a very small community, I joke sometimes that if I were to espouse a certain opinion, I might not be able to shop in the market anymore.
What opinion is that, Julie?
Wouldn't you like to know? But yeah. I'll add with that, I mentioned filter bubble. I'll also add the echo chamber. Yeah. And that is incredibly important, especially if you're on social media, because we are seeing a trend in tribalism in America. And Facebook and other social media feed that, absolutely feed that, because you're seeing in your social media feeds the things that your friends are interested in. Mm-hmm. And not just because they post it, but, also these algorithms, again, that are trying to serve you conveniently. And you are so, so much less likely to be exposed to information that will challenge your ideas. So much less likely, yes, than if you were just to open up a paper.
Right.
So another reason for engaging in critical thinking and doing that work is to be somewhat courageous and empowered, not go along with what you think you're expected to think, and mm-hmm. and have your friends look you in the eye and say, you're not from around here, are
right.
you?
Exactly.
The other thing is that we get manipulated, and people are making big bucks off of these kinds of ideas that are not being challenged. For example, and I think you might have seen this, but somebody posted some information about an upcoming, it's called the Conspiracy SEA Cruise. And I just want to read this. Here's the description of it. I looked it up on the internet to see what this conspiracy cruise was, And here's the description. During this incredible, mind-blowing, truth-telling, spiritually enriching event, we will do our best to uncover the truth about things conspiratorial, such as GMOs, Monsanto, bee colony collapse, ecology, global warming, climate change, autism, big pharma, medical suppression, vaccinations, fluoridation, and the World Bank. And that's the short list. I mean, there's about 100 of them on there. Plus, now they threw in this, you know, as an added bonus, we will explore how to heal ourselves and others and attain self-mastery and greater integrity through spiritual practices, manifestation, self-development, discernment, awakening, inner guidance, and inner peace.
That's a lot. That's a lot of stuff.
Sounds I want to like go.
Listen, you're listening to KHSU. I got it right the first time. This is Thursday Night Talk. My name is Eric Kirk. Julia Minton and Bob Frelick are my guests. They are talking about critical thinking and their show, Thinking Clearly, which is on sister station KMUD on the first Thursday of every month. And we're getting a little bit of a taste of what they're talking about and why. And they're going to talk a little bit more about that, but I do want to give callers a chance. Phone number is 826-4805, or if you're out of the area, 800-640-5911. That's 826-4805. If you want to text something in, it's 492-KHSU. Michael will be happy to read your question or comment over the air if you want to text that in, 492-KHSU. So why don't we move on?
We've had some wonderful guests, and we've tapped the resource here at Humboldt State University. We've had on our show philosophy professor Benjamin Schaefer. We've had Marcy Burstener, journalism, mass media department chair. We've had Tim Miller, digital media learning librarian, and we've had guests from other universities and things like that. But one of the guests that we were really excited about that we had on last edition of Thinking Clearly was Dr. Stephen Novella.
Better than Santa Claus, in my opinion.
It was amazing because I've heard his voice so often. He's the founder and host of Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Podcast is really worth listening to.
But he's actually a clinical neurologist, an assistant professor at the university, at Yale University. He's the executive director of a couple blogs, Science-Based Medicine. And he, according to Novella, he coined science-based medicine, departing from evidence-based medicine and carrying it into science-based medicine. He coined that term. And Neurologica is another blog that he does. And he's done two of the great courses on the Great Courses series. So he's a sort of upstream kind of guy. And so I'd like to play a clip, if it's okay with you.
Please.
From our show. So it starts out with Julia asking Dr. Novella a question and goes from there.
And, you know, in continuing the conversation kind of about science, evidence-based approaches, other than medicine, what fields of practice might benefit from evidence, science-based approaches?
Everyone. So I certainly anything that requires any investigation, any investigative specialty, really, really needs to understand critical thinking, the nature of deception, the pitfalls that we frequently fall into when trying to evaluate information. So, of course, you know, detectives, you know, lawyers, anything like that, even engineers, scientists, of course. The investigation itself is sort of an area that you can't really be good at it unless you, I think, are a critical thinker. But then again, pretty much any other area you care to mention, there's always some dimension of critical thinking and evidence that's involved. Certainly, we would love to have a government policy that is evidence-based. But you know, I think getting back to the Neil deGrasse Tyson thing, there's nothing wrong with wanting to have, you know, science and evidence be valued and to be like the sort of the number one consideration when evaluating and crafting policy. I think where the criticism was that that's not all you need, though, because there's a lot of value judgments and, you know, that go into policy as well. And, you know, science can inform us about how to achieve a goal, but they can't really tell us what that goal should be or how we balance that goal against other people who may have different goals and different sets of values. So there's lots of other layers there other than just science and evidence.
Political and social layers, value yeah. systems, ideologies. Well, what kind of sense can you make out of that? How can we make that work? How can we mesh those different approaches?
So, yeah, I mean, I think that this is where more philosophy comes into play. And also, again, that there are layers of critical thinking at play here. So if you understand how, what psychologists would call the default mode of human functioning, this is how most people function most of the time, we tend to engage in what we call motivated reasoning, right? Whenever we care about something, if we don't care, yeah, we'll listen to the evidence if it's not that important to us emotionally. But on any issue that we care about, which is like all of politics, right, we engage in motivated reasoning, which means we pick a team, you know, we pick a side, we pick a conclusion, and then we marshal all of our mental power figuring out ways to defend that position. Not to figure out what the best position is, but to defend this turf that we have staked out. And we're really good at that. But that's, of course, that's not very productive, because then you have people who are in entrenched positions and don't listen to each other and they're talking past each other. And then, of course, if your position is flawed, which, you know, most positions are going to be flawed in some way, in order to defend it, almost by definition, you have to distort the facts or engage in logical fallacies. You have to deny the science. And then when people do that, they start to deny science in general because it just gets in their way. So we see that happening all the time. But when you understand all of this and you understand the need for an internally valid process and an externally valid process, right, one that also comports with actual evidence about how the world works, then you realize that, okay, we have to slow down, back up, take a deep breath, and look at this from, you know, an objective, logical perspective, and I have to be flexible about my ideology or my conclusion because it may not be true or it may not be sufficient, it may not be complete, and I have to consider, you know, be fair to other people's opinions and their approaches. You know what I mean? So you start to value the process mm-hmm. and this sort of internal and external validity, and it's just a very different approach, but it's not the one we go to naturally. The one we go to naturally is motivated reasoning. The more reasonable approach is a much more high energy state. You have to work to get there and to stay there. And unfortunately, there's not a lot of motivation to do that. That, as far as I could see in politics, it seems like the motivation more is to pick your team and fight for it. You know, that seems to be what gets people riled up and, you know, gets people elected.
And the topic of the show is evidence-based practices and policies. And the thing that that kind of stimulated that topic and Novella did make a reference to that was, and I don't know if folks remember this, but last year Neil deGrasse Tyson, the new Carl Sagan, right, mm-hmm. Speaker for science, did a tweet, and the tweet read, "Earth needs a virtual country called Rationalia," or # Rationalia, "with a one-line constitution. All policy should be based on the weight of evidence." Do you remember that tweet?
I do. Yeah.
And do you remember all the articles that spawned? The blowback that Tyson got?
There's quite a whirlwind. Yeah.
There was a whirlwind. So that that gave us the idea for the topic.
Well, interesting. I mean, he did get into the politics again. You talk about your camp and your side, and sometimes that happens just even in science. You've got, you know, the people, they even get labels and all of that. One of the things that...
Well, I would add, I'm going to jump in there.
Sure.
Good.
And say science, much like critical thinking, is a method. Mm-hmm. It's a toolbox of skills that we use to try and understand the world around us. There are schools of thoughts and people do become entrenched. And those are people, not science. Again, science is a method. Right. People, however, have these tendencies. And really, none of us, no matter how hard we work at it, we can get better, but we're never free of it.
And with science, the yes, you have competing theories and that sort of thing, but given enough time, the best evidence wins out.
Well,
it goes forward, it moves forward, whereas in the social realm, it doesn't seem to be that same thing. You know, the camps stay entrenched. You know, we're more polarized in this country, I don't know, than any time I ever remember. And the world seems to be moving again into a pendulum swing and becoming even more polarized. So, you know, I guess I'm the perpetual optimist, as you know, that given enough time, I think we'll work this out culturally as a species, too.
Well, we're at the bottom of the hour, so let me do a little station ID. This is KHSU. You're listening to Thursday Night Talk. My name is Eric Kirk, Julia Minton, Bob Frelick, who are the hosts of KMUD's Thinking Clearly, are here talking about their program and critical thinking. Phone number, if you want to join, is 826-4805 or 800-640-5911. That's 826-4805 or 800-640-5911. Or if you want to text in a question or comment, 492-KHSU.
Well, I'll add somebody who's got my number texted me a little insight about some stuff we were discussing.
Somebody's
earlier.
Got your number. Huh?
Somebody's got my number.
All right.
And we were talking about beliefs earlier and how hard it is, and also how not just hard, but visceral it can be to have our beliefs challenged. And someone wrote in saying, the beliefs that are hardest to let go are the ones that worked for us in the past. The better they worked for us, the harder it is to let them go. And I thought that was very insightful, especially from a psychological point of view about, you know, what it is to navigate this world as a human.
Sure. And beliefs don't just occur in isolation. They are networked among a web of beliefs. And so sometimes one will take down others, like a domino effect. And so we would tend to hang on to those sort of more foundational, pivotal beliefs rather than collapse like a house of cards.
Yeah. Well, let me give an example, a personal example. When I was in high school, I decided I was a socialist, and I read up on Marx and dialectical materialism, and I proclaimed myself a dialectical materialist, and it fit in with an Isaac Asimov science fiction I'd read, Foundation, where somebody using science and math predicted all kinds of social developments and things that happened, and that if you just applied science and math, that you can actually social engineer, and it all seemed great to me until finally one day, it was actually a woman I was dating asked me to define dialectical materialism. And I spent about 20 minutes trying to do it, and I you know, tried to explain it and put on a show, and I thought about it and thought about it and then started reading up on it. And finally I decided, I think it was a few weeks later, my senior year of high school, it doesn't mean anything. There really is nothing to it. You've got some general words that are put out and the rest. And I also read, you know,
Hegel might disagree.
Well, I know, but it just the rest. It was just it was like, you know, before I could prove something, I had adopted a concept that I didn't even understand.
Yeah. Are you a sure. free market capitalist now?
No, I am not a free market capitalist. I'll tell more of that story another time. But Patty in Blocksburg, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello, Patty.
Hi. I want to applaud you for your subject and the fact that you're doing this critical thinking. I think it's extremely important in these times because I don't think we're taught to ask ourselves if we're right or wrong. You know, people just believe themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even we see in schools, tests are... you know, pick A, B, C, or D, or, you know, regurgitate the memories that, the things that you were taught in class.
Yeah, Auntie Jane, nobody's really teaching discussion. Well, I don't know, maybe they are. But I just wanted to comment on, I think you are touching in quite a bit on the the ego aspect of critical thinking and how we hang on to that. And there's this book by Thich Nhat Hanh called Understanding Our Mind. It's a great book. He really drives home the illusions that we all create and what we want to believe is true about anything and how we feed these seeds of illusion. And, you know, to learn to get these impressions and these feelings and these thoughts and to ask yourself to look at the opposite of what you're actually thinking is kind of a skill that takes some time. And I think that's kind of like what you're trying to talk about here is, you know, to ask yourself, am I thinking clearly? Am I right?
You're right.
You're right, and you got the show name right in that comment. And what it gets me thinking about is that you're talking about confirmation bias. There's a reward center in the brain. Serotonin is one of the neurotransmitters that is involved in the reward part of our brain that gives us this kind of good feeling about something, and we're exposed to this serotonin drip all the time. That's what causes clicks on a lot of these website pages that are confirming our biases. You know, we're going there. It's a quid pro quo. We're clicking. They get sponsors. The more clicks we make, and we get that serotonin drip.
Get a little hit.
So the whole idea is, how do we change that around and get rewarded and get that serotonin going by actually looking at the evidence and questioning our beliefs and trying to get closer and closer to something that's reality?
Well, it's going to be kind of difficult because of the internet, because I am one of those very rare people who just got on. I literally just got on the internet, and I had not been on it for all these years.
Good luck to you.
You should be studied.
I know, that's what I think. Because I actually do have impressions. You know, I felt like it's very flickery. And the short attention span situation where everything is, well, a lot of the things are 7 minutes, 8 minutes, 6 minutes. And then all that stuff, you know, you get all these little things you want to check into. Oh, it's a little bit of information. And it just, they don't follow through with it. It just...
Yeah, but there is.
I find it very annoying.
There is some good stuff. You may have to dig for it. You may have to, you know, be patient and go through. But you will find and you will gravitate towards stuff if you're looking for it.
Myself questions, and I think, okay, I want to check this out. Like in regard to, I wanted to find out how many public schools there were, and in regard to the money that Trump wants to spend, you know, and. You know, I am trying to, every day I look at the internet, I try to ask myself questions, okay, what would I like to be interested in?
Well, I think you said something.
It could be kind of annoying in a way.
I think you said something very important. That's rather than go to the internet and accept that information that's streaming at you, ask yourself some questions to start with, and then search out the answers for that.
That's really what I want to do, because I can see myself being led. You know, I'm being led here and there, and it's just like, I don't want to be that way. Obviously, I'm not into being led, seeing how I have not been. But I just really want to applaud you all so much for this subject that you're bringing up, and that you're encouraging. I love to see it go into schools, you know, more, and because I'm very worried about the future of our children, and the they're saying the attention spans are lower, you know, and do people even ask questions and of themselves and others? I don't know.
We did a show that was that was, I think, really interesting. It was an exploration of the Common Core. And the Common Core the idea of the Common Core is it's kind of based on critical thinking, collaboration, and
it's the educational standard now that's been implemented.
Exactly.
Yeah, and it's also called California Standard.
California Standard.
Something like that.
They've changed the name several times,
and it's been, especially you can go on the internet and you can definitely find some controversial YouTube conspiracy videos. Common Core.
Oh, speaking of conspiracy, the advertisement you said, Bob, about the conspiracy of all those different things, it sounds very a religious-based statement trying to get people that are worried about the world to kind of come together and believe those things are conspiracies.
It could be the Moonies. Who knows?
The Moonies. One of the hallmarks of Tibetan Buddhism is that they discuss things back and forth. And I really think that is important, that people need to talk more.
All right. Well, Patty, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks. All right.
I did really enjoy that show Bob and I did about Common Core, because I really didn't know that much about it. And I believe it's been implemented just in the last few years. And I see my friends who have kids struggling to help their kids with their homework, especially math homework, because it doesn't look like, it's not the same math homework that we did when we were kids.
No, it's not.
And I understand how that frustration, it's like, what are they doing? What's going on here? And I learned so much about why Common Core, why it was built the way it was, why so many of these things look different. And I recognized a lot of those things that, like those silly little memes that go around on the internet. Common Core will have you believe 2 + 2 = 5, mm-hmm. and things like that. And I reflect back when I was a math tutor when I was 16, 17 years old. And there were parents who would pay me good money to come tutor their kids and to teach them these math tricks that are now part of the basic academic standard.
Well,
it's real emotional when your kids are involved. I mean, I remember when I was in school, they had something they were calling new math. It got kind of trashed. And apparently the Venn diagram has been abandoned as a teaching tool for set theory. But I know for a fact that that's how I learned set theory. Now, this is anecdotal, of course, but but I'm looking at it. It's like, how can you not understand set theory from looking at that thing? It outlines it in a picture. But apparently evidence-based, studies of it showed it was extremely ineffective. Kids just did not get it. For whatever reason, I was weird. It worked for me.
Yeah.
But it didn't work for others.
See, the Common Core and the thing that's confusing to parents that don't really get prepared enough on the background of the Common Core is that rather than learn the algorithms, long division, just the method, like we did when I went to school, you actually are beginning to have fun with numbers and play with numbers and be creative with the numbers and see why those algorithms actually work.
Right.
And so that's what they're trying to do, not only in math, but in science. It's, the Common Core is throughout, not every subject, but many of the subjects.
I don't want to get too distracted, but why don't they do geometry proofs anymore? That was one of the most fun things I ever experienced.
You are weird.
I loved it. And it was fun, but they just say, oh, it's too hard. It's not too hard. Anyway, but that's...
I had fun with matrices, so I'm not one to talk.
All right. Well, where are we on your outline there?
I was thinking, that one of the things I always like to ask people, and because you're a host, we're hosts, that kind of thing, is what did you learn? And so I was hoping that you'd ask us that question.
There you go.
Do you have another question for us, Eric?
No, why don't we start with
that? You can tell
who
the teacher in the room is.
what have you learned from the experience? And in fact, that was in our promo, so we have to actually follow through if we're not going to be accused of false advertising.
Nothing.
You did say you were going to learn.
I learned nothing. That's what kids, when you ask them, what'd you learn in school today? Nothing.
More stuff.
Well, you know, because I prepared, I thought about that. I thought Ari's going to ask us that question. Right? And I thought about it.
It was in the promo. I was supposed to.
I racked my brain about that. But because doing the show, and you know, we've done our 11th episode, so we haven't been into it quite a year yet. And it's has been a real learning experience for me. Julia can have her own ideas about this, but for me, it's been an opportunity to really dig into some things that that I'd be thinking about anyway at this age in my life. And I was thinking about this, I was thinking sort of in images, and I got the idea that I'm like a bloodhound in the back of a pickup driving through a neighborhood. Have you ever seen those dogs in the back of a pickup? What do they? They stick their nose up in the air, and they take in all those smells, right? Mm-hmm. They're making a map. They're seeing little bits and pieces of things in the neighborhood. Well, that's happened to me, but it's also happened that I've realized that got to jump out of that pickup and start walking down the alleys, mm-hmm. and getting into the complexities and the details of things. So it's opened up a whole new sort of intellectual life for me to get into some of these issues, and I've learned a number of things from guests. But let me kick it over to Julia here and see what she has to say.
It's really hard for me to kind of bullet point what I've learned. It's been an incredible experience so far. Most of all, I really appreciate the dialogue, the cultivating the conversation. Kind of like Bob said, if I wasn't doing this radio show, I would be having these conversations. So I appreciate that we bring in people that enhance the conversation. I really enjoyed the one show I was too sick to attend was we had Bob had Jevin West,
yeah,
from
Professor University of Washington,
right? Who I'll also give a thank you out to librarian Tim Miller, who introduced us to their website.
Thank you, Tim. That was a great show.
Calling BS, we'll say.
Yeah.
You just spell that out.
The long version.
Yeah. The after 10 p.m. version.
The one we can't say.
Callingbs.org. I enjoyed that so much. It was great having Tim Miller. We had a great conversation with him, and he kind of left us with that little tidbit and went back and checked it out. And it just so hit the nail on the head at this time in this part of the world, in this time in my life, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, of just feeling really perplexed day after day, scratching my head and just going, what the heck is going on around here already? And sometimes it is so overwhelming with all this information. I mean, just in the last 48 hours, if you're a bit of a newsie like Eric and I over here and you follow some of the politics and stuff, the last 48 hours have been absolutely madness. And
crazy.
It's hard to tell heads from tails. And cultivating more of these tools and resources for just navigating our way through the world, and also practicing how to have these conversations. 'Cause like I said, I like the idea of promoting the dialogue, of having a meeting of minds, especially when those minds come from different places, have different preconceived ideas, and then you can put them on the table and you can examine them together. To me, that's the road to world peace, mm-hmm. not these divisions of tribalism. You go to your corner, I'm going to go to mine, and we'll fist fight in the middle. But promoting ways that we can talk to each other, we can talk to each other as neighbors, we can talk to each other in challenging but friendly ways, and we can expand our understanding of each other and of the world we live in. And like I said, I am not the eternal optimist, but I honestly believe that is our way out, that we need to learn how to talk to each other.
Yeah, one of the other avenues of learning on this, doing the show for me, has been our guests. We've had a couple guests that have emphasized how important it is when you're trying to research an issue, get information about an issue, to go to the original sources. And I find that when I do that, what looks like a cut and dry black and white issue has a lot of nuances to it. Mm-hmm. It's not so much a marching call to action as it seemed to be when we heard it on the news, or breakthrough in science, whatever the wherever piece of information that we got. When you really go to the original sources, much more nuanced, but that brings up the issue, and I agree with that. Go to the original sources. But it also brings up the issue that it's very difficult to do. I mean, unless you know something about research design, if you're looking at a medical study or a psychological study, for example, you don't know whether it's a, it's a good design and what the pitfalls of using that particular design is. Now authors of credible articles in their discussion part of their article should cover that. They should cover what the weaknesses of their research design and research is and what could be done differently to continue the research in the area. So that's, but you could look at the discussion. So you can go to an abstract and the discussion part and skip some of the stuff in between that's so technical that you really can't figure out what it's talking about. Yeah. Because not only do you have to have an idea of research design, but you have to have some idea of the subject matter. But I think Novella said this too, is that the more you do this, the more you actually try that, the better you get at it, mm-hmm. and that it's worth the practice doing.
Yeah, it becomes less intimidating. It's more accessible. I will also add, I completely agree with everything Bob said, which isn't always the case.
Almost never.
but it is when you zoom in and you see all those little nuances that make up a headline or even, a subtitle. Just as much as that is true, if you zoom out and you see the bigger perspective, you put it in context, things also look different that way. I remember, I think the last time we were at KHSU, we were discussing, I don't have the article in front of me, but it's very common on social media and on the web to see breakthrough new science, mm-hmm. breakthrough discovery. But if it's not repeatable, it's useless. And there was an article that I had talked about here last time about more times than not, those breakthrough pieces end up really just going nowhere and actually being proven false or not quite accurate. It's that repeatability. Yeah. It's the birth of the science, and as well as the consensus. So on many levels, looking in, zooming in, looking at the minutia, the nuances that make up a single argument, and then also pulling out and seeing the bigger picture and how does it fit into this and how does it fit into the rest of it.
Yeah. And I remember another thing I learned from one of our guests, Marcy Bersinger, mm-hmm. who's a faculty member here at HSU. I think we asked her something like, what can people do to improve their chances of getting accurate and reliable news? And her comment surprised me. It was something I never thought of, but should have thought of. She said, you remember what she said?
Mm-mm.
Okay. She said, be willing to pay for it. which makes sense because the print journalism is expensive. I mean, if you're just republishing something that was published something else, or publishing a press release almost verbatim without the fact checking, the analysis that takes a lot of time, energy, and expense. Mm-hmm. Then you're getting what you pay for.
we're getting towards the top, and there is a question I wanted to get to, and it is involving reading from my blog. I did post a promo for the show on the blog, but it actually is to address a larger, more important question. And I'm going to start reading. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it's this person posted, and this is a person who has a definite agenda that is kind of different from ours. It's ask yourself if you've ever truly critically thought about chemtrails. Ask yourself if you've written off the subject of such weather manipulation as baseless conspiracy theory. Can you filter the tinfoil out of the timeline? I don't know what that sentence means exactly, but the behavior of man-made clouds has been changing very rapidly and dramatically right over our humbled heads. So here's somebody who claims to just be looking at the sky, looking at the evidence, and seeing something that the three of us don't see. Why is that? I mean, what is it that this person sees that we don't see? How does critical thinking, you know, relate to that? I say, why do we have to even think critically? I'm looking at it. It's not what I was looking at when I was a child. It looks different. I watch these clouds and what they do, and it's not, you know. So how do we address that when you've got somebody who's not talking about some abstract concept that they believe in, but what they're looking at in the sky?
Oh, I was looking in the sky. I'm sorry. Well, my reaction to that is that the first part of the question, I think, is a good question. You know, have you written off, you know, chemtrails as baseless conspiracy theory? That's a germane question, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a question that I would ask myself. Do I have a cognitive bias that it's a very, very improbable conspiracy theory? Probably so. So that's something that I'd have to think about more. But in response to the second part that the person who wrote that gets into, is that looking up in the sky and using personal anecdotal evidence. Anecdotal evidence is kind of the starting point for research. Certainly not the anything that's going to cause us to draw a claim or a conclusion.
There are a couple questions in there. Mm-hmm. That kind of stumped me. The first question, have I written off chemtrails? No, I haven't. At this point in time, I have not seen enough evidence to be convinced. Mm-hmm. If people have new evidence, I'm open to it. Clearly, looking at the sky doesn't work for me. I don't know. I will go along with, I'll piggyback on what Bob said, is that anecdotal subjective evidence is a good place to start, but isn't where you end. Mm-hmm. So even if I look up in the sky and I see it and I kind of go, I don't know, that doesn't mean it's over for me. But that I would ask other people, could you provide me some more evidence?
Or information or analysis or something.
And have you looked at all the evidence? Right. Have you done a search for robust search for all evidence, both that confirms what you might believe and what you...
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
No.
For instance, when they say, I didn't see this when I was a kid. All right. Well, okay, but we have to acknowledge that our memories might be flawed. And then when somebody presents, well, here are pictures of contrails from 1940s, 1950s, 1960s, here they are. Sometimes a lot of them around a certain airport. So you don't remember seeing that as a kid, and yet here they are from before you were even born. So you have to consider that. Well, one of the things is to reject and say they weren't really from the 40s and 50s. I mean, that's the first thing.
And when you say, have you examined all the evidence? I got to say straight up, no. No, I haven't. Of course I haven't. It's right. Not really an interest of mine. And that's okay. Like, I'm just one person. Mm-hmm. If you want to talk about the taxonomical variations of pit vipers, we can talk, because that's mm-hmm. something I have an interest in. And that's where, you know, we can't all be specialists in everything. Mm-hmm. There are some things, you know, I like reptiles. Let's talk about reptiles. I've taken a preliminary look at it, but it simply hasn't interested me to the same extent. And I'm okay with that. But then at the same time, if there are folks who want to present some new, interesting information analysis, I'm open to it. I am. But I'm not going out of my way to further inform myself.
So since we're piggybacking, I'm going to piggyback on Julia here, that we cannot. Critical thinking takes work. It's difficult to do. So my suggestion is for people to prioritize those things that are important to you for one reason or another. They're important personally, or you think they're important for you to know to be a good citizen, whatever. But to prioritize and begin using critical thinking processes on those, not everything in the world.
And I'll come back to dialogue real quick and share it. Help curate the information. Share it with the people around you.
Well, let's prioritize for the last 15 seconds. What's your next show about? First week on Thursday, KMUD 98.1 or 88.1 up here, yes.
We were just talking about this tonight, lining up the next three shows. But the show will be narratives as they relate to critical thinking.
All right. Well, thank you, Bob Froelich and Julia Minton. And thank you, Michael, for doing a great job of engineering. We're actually over time here. So until next time.
You've been listening to Thursday Night Talk on KHSU. Thanks to our host, Eric Kirk, and our guests, Julia Minton and Bob Froelich. We love to get feedback on our programs. Please email Thursday Night Talk at khsu.org and like our Facebook page, Thursday Night Talk on KHSU.